So our first speaker this morning is Professor Sir Michael Brady, who is currently a professor of oncological imaging at Oxford and was previously a professor in information engineering at Oxford. He is also the co-director of the Oxford Cancer Imaging Center, one of four national cancer imaging centers in the UK. Prior to Oxford, Mike Brady was a senior research scientist at MIT, where he was one of the founders of the robotics lab. Mike is the author of articles and patents in computer vision, robotics, medical image analysis, and artificial intelligence, and the author or editor of 10 books. He has also co-founded several startup companies. He serves on the board of several companies. Mike has been elected a Fellow of the Royal Society, of the Royal Academy of Engineering, of the Institution of Engineering and Technology, of the Institute of Physics, of the Academy of Medical Sciences, and a Fellow of the British Computer Society. He was knighted in 2003. He's been awarded honorary doctorates by several universities, including the University Paul Sabatier in France. Mike.
Mesdames, Messieurs, après la chute des Anglais au Mondial, je veux dire simplement, allez les Bleus. I want you to look at the pictures mostly rather than listening to me. There is a film, and I'm more than happy to make the slides available. I want to cover four things this morning in my talk, which is predominantly about cancer. Roughly speaking, half the population of the UK will get cancer at some point during their life by the time of 2020, and about approximately 38% will survive, many will not. If we look at the progression of cancers, which I don't have time to go through right now, what you can see from the pink circle on the left is the predominance of breast cancer. So breast cancer, colorectal cancer, liver cancer have been the main subjects of my research. And I'm going to talk a little bit to start with about breast cancer and then about colorectal cancer. Breast cancer incidence is approximately 1 in 8 women. And that's not just in developed countries, because what we're seeing now in developing countries, including China and India, Brazil, is that the numbers are rising very rapidly. They're already at 1 in 11, and it is predicted within the next 10 years they'll be at 1 in 8 women. And the numbers are increasing. That 1 in 8 was 1 in 10, but 10 years ago. And one of the reasons for this is increased urbanization, changes in lifestyle, which impact particularly on younger women. There is a central dogma in cancer, which is that if you can get early detection, together with chemo and radiotherapy and conservative surgery, then together with appropriate epidemiology, then we can transform the morbidity of cancer. The first stop now in detecting cancer, and it will be for the next 10 to 20 years, is mammography. And there's a fundamental problem with mammography, which is in fact the dependence of images upon the parameters. Here are two images of two breast images to give you an idea of the kinds of images. And we asked two of the UK's most experienced radiologists to examine those two mammograms in order to estimate the percentage of dense, i.e. non-fat tissue, which is a key risk factor for breast cancer. I'll come back to that. So the person on the left, BK, who's a very experienced radiologist, estimated 25% of the breast was dense tissue. The equally experienced radiologist on the right estimated 40%. However, these images were taken 10 minutes apart. They are the same breast, and it's rather like taking a photograph with an old black and white camera where you change the f-stop and so forth and film speed. You get very different images. The point is, and it's true for everything that you'll see today, and that is that image intensity relates to anatomy in an extremely complex way, and that makes quantitative image analysis extremely difficult. So if I look back 20 years ago, I decided that the only way in which we could make headway on this was in fact to try to build a model of the physics, which is one of the themes that Nicola has been stressing throughout his course. In part, that led to a book which Ralph Heinem and I developed. I'm not going to show you very much in the way of physics. I simply want to show you that there is a thing called Beer's Law. Beer, of course, plays a very important role in the UK. But Beer's Law basically tells you the way in which the fluence of X-rays are attenuated or absorbed as they pass through tissue. And the point of the little thing, picture on the right-hand side, is that it is fundamentally projective. You cannot tell where the piece of tissue with attenuation mu2 is relative to the other two. That's a fundamental limitation, although there are now technologies trying to overcome that. So if we look at a model of mammographic image formation, then what we see from the device on the left-hand side, you see that the X-rays pass through the upper plate, which is leucite, through the breast, whose contents are not known, and through the bottom. We do know what the spectrum of X-rays leaving the tube will be. And if we do a little bit of physics, what we end up with is a model of the energy which in the end finds its way into the camera at the bottom of the image. Now, that's a pretty disgusting equation to look at this early in the morning. So let's see if we can make a little bit of headway. Well, the literature tells us that you cannot distinguish stromal tissue, that's collagen and so forth, and tumours on the basis of X-ray attenuations. The literature's wrong. That was a secret. And it tells us then that there are just two kinds of tissue, fat and non-fat, which we call interesting. So if we know the separation between the plates, then we know at any particular pixel that there's a certain amount of fat, say H-fat, and a certain amount of interesting tissue, say H-int. Our job is to find H-int. So now let's go back to that little bit of equation, and it turns out it's not bad news because we measure the thing on the left. All that stuff in the middle, that horrible mathematics that, you know, is the stuff of nightmares, actually is all calibrated. We know all of those parameters. We know the compression plates. The bit we don't know is just the bit at the end. So we can actually solve from a whole series of observations, we can solve for the bit we don't know. And so if we look at what that amounts to, that's just the attenuations of the interesting and the fat tissue. We don't know H-int, but since we know the separation between the plates, we can rearrange that. And so the only variable now that we don't know is H-int. And so basically, if we can solve for that by inverting this equation, we can solve for that. And what we end up with that is then, if we take a mammogram, we can now move from this model of the physics, and we can produce a surface on which we can do interesting mathematics, such as differential geometry on these manifolds that we have over here to find characteristic shapes of tumours. And from that, we can then begin to determine the amount of breast density, the volume of breast, etc. In short, we turn what was an image with very, very wide parameter dependence into numbers. And that's really what the whole of this game is about. Turning things into numbers. Now, there was a fundamental problem with the story I just showed you, which was that string of all of those horrible parameters and that integral. And that's okay if we know that data, but sometimes we don't. And so recently, together with Martin Yaffe in Toronto and Nico Kasemeyer in Nijmegen, Ralph and I have revisited our work. And what we found is that actually, if we knew a region of the breast that was entirely fat, some point, for example, here, then in fact we can use that as a reference and we can take away all of the parameter dependency. We can reform all of the physics and show that we can marginalize out that kind of thing. Now, actually, marginalize out is a term that I use deliberately because fundamentally what you can do is you can turn this problem from physics into a Bayesian probabilistic analysis. And in essence, that's what Nico and Ralph and I have done. I mentioned that breast density was important. Why is it important? Well, what we should understand is why women have mammograms in the first place. And that is that when a woman goes through the menopause, the dense tissue, which is there not for the titillation of men, which is what the tabloid papers in the UK believe, but rather in order to nourish babies, that dense tissue converts to fat. It's a process called involution. It's a very, very complex cascade of biochemical processes. Some women in their 50s typically do not undergo involution. They stay resolutely dense. That creates a perfect storm. It's harder to see the tumours. They are, for reasons which are not understood, more likely to have a tumour, and the phenotype of that tumour is more serious. So women with dense breasts towards the end of their 50s suffer a triple whammy, and it's those women that we really need to concentrate upon. All of the problems with mammography are not to do with the women who do not have dense breasts, who involute, it's to do with the women who stay dense. That leads us to stratification. If we can identify those women, then we can get them off to have alternative imaging. So, mammography is only 48% effective in dense breasts compared with 98% for women who are not dense. That tells us that identifying those women with dense breasts is absolutely fundamental. And as I say, cancer is 4 times more likely in women with dense breasts. Now, of course, American radiologists have coined a whole series of criteria by which they judge density, and I've written them down here. Let's just pull one out. Whoops. Let's just pull one out at random. Category 3. The breast tissue is heterogeneously dense, which could obscure detection of small masses. Note that calls upon the perception of clinicians. It's not scientific. It's not rigorous. It's not precise. Wouldn't it be nice if we could replace that with something that was precise? And that's exactly what the goal of our research has been. So I showed you this system, this little display before. This is from a company that I've started, where we took that mathematics and we translated it out to form a company. And so here is the very fatty breasts. This one, I've shown an analogy, by the way, with the sky. So this is that this is obviously the sky over London pretty much all the time. Here's the sky in Paris. This is the this is 2 on that in the BI-RADS classification and in ours. And we get closer and closer, finally, to the Côte d'Azur. Just to give you an idea, this was developed within our laboratory 20 years ago. It's now in a company. We have processed approximately 2 million mammograms over the past 12 months. We are now processing approximately a quarter of a million mammograms per month, which is very interesting because it offers an opportunity for big data analysis of the type which I hope that Antonio Criminisi will talk about a little later this morning. So that was just an attempt to show you some of the work that we've done on mammography, but of course our aim was to find those women whose breasts were dense, and so the idea is that you take those images, and while the woman is still in the clinic, you tell them that they're dense and you offer alternative forms of imaging to supplement mammography, either, for example, ultrasound or MRI. Now, in MRI, what we need is to use a contrast agent, and the reason is that basically, if you look at the MRI characteristics, the T1, the T2 of tumor tissue, it's very, very similar to surrounding healthy tissue. On the other hand, if you inject a contrast agent, you may just be able to see, despite the poor contrast, that there's a part there that comes very, very bright very quickly. And that is because of a process known as angiogenesis, or the increased perfusion around a tumour, I'll come back to. So if we look at the take-up of the contrast agent, which is typically gadolinium or some other chelate of a lanthanide, you get this distinction between malignant tissue and fat. So that we can model again the using the block equation to take up the take up of a contrast agent, and you get this little equation down here, which is not that difficult to find. We want to find T2 star, we know R2, we know R1, we can choose the flip angle, we know this stuff. In practice, then, what we can end up with is the following. This is an example taken from our clinic in Oxford. Here's a woman who, pre-chemotherapy, she was determined to have a tumour just there. She had chemotherapy, and this is the MRI image taken after chemotherapy. And if you look at those intensities, what would you conclude as a doctor? Well, you'd say, well, gee, there has been a certain amount of response to the chemotherapy. Maybe we should keep it going for another 6 months, okay? Because it's clearly gotten smaller. On the other hand, if you look at the kind of analysis that we've just been doing, that image translates from intensity to this image, which is to do with the take-up of contrast agent concentration. What you see here is a very different picture of that tumor. You see an advancing cycle of tumor, which is the yellow ring, which is in fact the angiogenesis surrounding the tumor, and in the blue in the middle is the necrotic center. And if you take that image and you look at it, you get that. The diagnosis in this case, or the therapy step in this case, is, Mrs. Jones, your tumor has been cured. Here, you have another 6 months of chemotherapy. Your hair will fall out, you'll feel sick, and so forth. Now, if you're going to do that, then we better believe our mathematics if we're going to have that kind of decision on women. I just simply want to point that out. So this is not a video game, this is for real people. I want to show you a little bit of work now that my colleague Manav Bhushan, together with Professors Mark Jenkinson and Yulia Schnabel, have done. And here we can see in a colorectal cancer, you see the take-up of the contrast agent. But if we look at that, we would like to be able to fit a model of the take-up, but we'd also like to be able to solve for the motion. And what we've done in this case is we've done those two steps simultaneously. For those of you who really get off on mathematics and really need a fix of equations, that's actually what's happening. Let me show you what's really happening here. We take the original data. Here, the tumor, this is the rectum. You can see this large tumor surrounding it. Here you can see the data popping around. Here we've corrected the motion, but we've simultaneously solved for the take-up, the pharmacokinetic parameters. Here on this is simulated data. We injected a motion here just to test the algorithm. The actual motion, the actual take-up was that black line. If you look at the algorithm I just sketched out for you, that simultaneous optimization, it's this purple. If you simply did deformable registration, you end up with one of these, which is much, much poorer. So going to real data, what we look at are the difference between those people who respond to therapy and those people who do not respond to therapy. Here is a shocking thing for you to know. The people who have colorectal cancer quite often have a surgical resection. Surgical resection removes that from your butt, le cul, and the person then carries a stoma. Here is the tragedy. It turns out that 10% of people who have that operation, when you then do histology, did not need that operation in the first place. Wouldn't it be nice if we could find those people who were total responders so we could avoid that operation? So here, if we just take normalized cross-correlation or mutual information or some such thing, there's very, very little difference between the responders and non-responders. On the other hand, if you look at this simultaneous estimation of the motion and the therapy and the take-up, then you get a very significant difference. In fact, let me quantify what I mean by significant. Here, there is very little in the way using a particular thing which is known as the Kolmogorov-Smirnov distance. That's just a statistical parameter for things which are non-parametric. In essence, what we find is a very statistically significant difference between responders and non-responders using the method which I've just shown you. Now, let me now move into the third of four things I wanted to tell you about today. What, in the end, can cure cancer? The answer is approximately 49 to 50% is surgery, approximately 40% is radiotherapy, and actually relatively little in the way of chemotherapy at the moment. That's actually a lie, because the judicious combination of radiotherapy with chemotherapy actually is better than either of them by themselves. But just to make a point, it shows the importance of both radiotherapy and surgery. There are many hallmarks of cancer. I'm going to talk about just one of them, which is in fact the EGFR inhibitors. Let me give you an example. I think it's extremely instructive if we look at a melanoma, which is in fact the dominant cancer in the United States, skin cancer, for all of you who see Scottish people lying on the beaches of the Côte d'Azur, turning themselves into salmon. Basically, people with melanoma have an activated mutation of a particularly important protein, which is known as BRAF. We know that RAF is inhibited, or can be inhibited, by a particular drug which is known as vemurafenib, which has the name PLX4032, which really rolls off the tongue. And this is an inhibitor of this particular kinase. Okay, and this is a pathway, one of the most fundamental pathways from growth factor, which is why I said I was looking at growth factors, way the way down to angiogenesis down here. Here's an example of a person with a very extensive melanoma. This is a 38-year-old man with this particular BRAF mutant melanoma. And this is a positron emission tomography image. You can see all of those black dots are tumors. This guy is not in good shape. That's what happens after 3 weeks of giving vemurafenib. That's quite remarkable. And indeed, so much so that Brian Drucker, who's one of the top oncologists in the world, said, "This is one of the best examples I've ever seen of science triumphing over disease." Wonderful. However, that's before treatment, that's after 15 weeks of treatment, and that's after 23 weeks of treatment. Tumors are fundamentally agile. They learn how to deal with any particular hostile environment, such as chemotherapy, to which they've been subjected. They mutate. They mutate very, very rapidly indeed. Fundamentally, we need to understand the processes of mutation, because that is where all the action is in cancer right now. It's what I'm going to come back to at the end. The whole subject of epigenetics now is really beginning to offer, for the first time, deep insights into the whole process of mutations within cancers. Now, this is a salutary lesson, but it's not all bad news. So if I can just show you a little bit of biology, just a tiny bit. This is just a very simple picture of the basement membrane around any particular tissue. In fact, this is taken from a ligament in the leg. And indeed, one of the things that we now know is that if you cut yourself and you get a wound, and you look at the processes of wound healing, they are in fact exactly the processes that have been hijacked by tumors, because we are so spectacularly good of being able to repair wounds, that tumors have used that and exploited it in order for their rapid growth. And you can look at a whole cascade of processes from the time when you've got a damage to the vasculature, for example, when you cut yourself, and all of these growth factors and endothelial growth factors and so forth, and they will lead in the end to angiogenesis. Okay? So that's a normal process. Now, in fact, what happens is that in normal tissue, you will get a very, very regular set of microvascular vessels like this. Tumors have developed a spectacular variant of that. in which they grow a chaotic, and I mean in the sense of mathematics, chaotic vasculature, which is leaky. And they provide the tumor, in particular the tumor microenvironment, with disproportionate amounts of nourriture. So there are many targets for angiogenesis to image it, to try to understand if we can repair it. And I've just simply shown you six of the standard ones here. The ones in red are the two that we have worked on most closely, one to do with adhesion molecules, to do with VCAM, which is now being used to repair stroke and multiple sclerosis, and the other one, growth factors and receptors. So here we look at integrin imaging, and here we look at VEGF-A, vascular endothelial growth factor. I want to show you a little bit of work that we've done on integrin targeting for angiogenesis. So basically what we can do is we can look at alpha V beta 3, which is a particular protein, and that mediates the migration of the endothelial cells throughout the basement membrane, which is that flat picture I showed you just a little bit before. And that binds to a whole series of peptides which contain a particular amino acid sequence, which is in fact this arginine glycine aspartic acid, otherwise known as RGD. We, together with GE have developed a radio-labeled version of RGD, and we've done quite a lot of work now in analysing and quantifying the take-up of that tumour. And in particular, what we're doing is we're looking at these various endothelial growth factors and looking at the way in which we can target angiogenesis. And more to the point, what we're interested in is taking these cellular cascades and then finding a bunch of drugs that inhibit some of the main players on this particular protein cellular cascade. You may have heard of a drug known as Herceptin. Herceptin is bevacizumab here, and it will inhibit this particular one here. And Avastin, not Herceptin. Here, what we've done is we've bound that and we're doing SPECT imaging. So this is the kind of thing in a mouse, a xenografted model, that we've been doing here. We've got CT, we've got SPECT and so forth, and we're doing image fusion to do that. So that's just one of the ways in which you can move from cellular cascades through imaging and the inhibition of particular things such as angiogenesis. And then from that, one can begin to look at the biodistribution and the immunohistochemistry, because there's no point in killing off a tumour if you also kill off a whole pile of things such as the spleen and the lungs and the heart and so forth. So you have to look at this immunohistochemistry and biodistribution as well. And that's, in essence, what we've been doing here, looking at the VEGF and the Avastin. That's a paper which is just coming out in Nature over the next few weeks. I want to finish with just a couple of pictures, which is, I started off by talking about tumours at the level of clinical images before I moved into looking at cellular pathways. I now want to come back and look effectively at the phenotype, at the shape of tumours. And here you can see a very simple tumour modelled with a sphere inside the liver. However, many tumours don't grow like spheres. They grow in a much more complex way, and these are clones, each one of which corresponds to a mutation of the DNA. And the question now is, what can we learn about these complex tumour shapes? What we did was we developed a tumour growth model where we took a bunch of spheres which were put together. Spheres is a natural growth process. It's isotropic, particularly in the liver. The tissue is fairly similar, but when you get a new clone that develops, it grows as an adjunct sphere. So here you can see a resected specimen, and here you can see the CT prior to the resection of that specimen. So in that case, you have the picture here. You then give 9 months of therapy, And you can see that some of those spheres will have grown and some of them will in fact shrink. So we conjectured that the genomes of the samples within a spheroid would show minor variation, but within the genomes of samples from different spheroids, that we would have substantial variation. We wanted to test that hypothesis. How do you test that hypothesis? Is you use what is known as array comparative genome hybridization, where effectively you take all of the chromosomes and you map the genes in a log scale to show the amplification of each of those genes. Now, these days with epigenetics, this analysis is becoming more and more sophisticated. This was done 5 years ago. What I'm showing you here are two such points where we've taken these ACGHs, both from a spheroid, and you can see one from one spheroid, and you can see that they're very, very similar in their genomic expression. Here is a different spheroid, and again, you can show that two places within that one are very, very similar in their genomic expression, but you can see that between these two, there are significant differences. What can you do with that information? And the answer is two things. One, you can now begin to build, from the shape of that tumor, a history of the mutational processes, because each one builds upon another. So now you can actually build a tree structure of the set of mutations, the sequence of mutations that happened within that tumor. But more to the point, to get back to the clinical thing, is the following. I said earlier we need numbers. So if you look at the response evaluation criteria in solid tumors, the RECIST criterion, which is used universally throughout medicine, then what you find is that disease progression amounts to an increase by about 20% in the longest linear dimension. Disease response is decreased by 30% in the longest linear dimension. Otherwise, the disease is considered stable. This was the 9-month tumor shape we had. That's the 12-month tumor shape we had. So according to these rules, this is stable disease. But let's actually look below the surface. If we take our spheres, then what we'll find is that some of these responses, green, are actually growing, and in particular, one of them is growing very aggressively, whereas another one is shrinking. In short, although that appears to be stable disease, it is far from stable. This is a truly aggressively growing tumor that the analysis which I've just shown you of using that piecewise spherical model together with ACGH, which is routine now, absolutely routine clinical data, shows you can get aggressive growth. In short, what I've tried to tell you about over the past few minutes has been, one, the need to model the physics of image of acquisition. Two, the need to model beyond that into physiology, for example, into the angiogenesis, into the blood flow characteristic of a tumor. Thirdly, that we need to get inside cellular processes to understand things like angiogenesis, or indeed the many other processes of cancer. And then finally, that we can link those cellular processes and that genetics and epigenetics right the way back to the kind of morphological information that we deal with on a clinical day-by-day basis within our hospitals. So they're just tasters. Please look at the slides and please look at the movie. But I thank you for your attention.